The first case on the calendar is case 21-369, Daniel Latu v. Blanch. We have one counsel appearing by video. Sir, can you hear us?
Yes, Your Honor, I can.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Welsh.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Eric Welsh, and I represent the petitioner, Daniel Latu. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This court should grant the petition for review and remand because the agency abused its discretion, deprived Mr. Latu of due process, and reached a decision that is arbitrary and capricious. Moreover, in consideration of this court's very recent decision in United States v. Lopez, Mr. Latu may no longer be removable at all. Daniel Latu immigrated.
What's the reference to that? I mean, that's not part of the briefing, I don't think, but what are you alluding to?
Yes, Your Honor. This is a recent case that was decided at the end of July. United States v. Lopez, the court found that the crime of corporal injury to a spouse or a cohabitant is not a crime of violence. And in that case, this court specifically analyzed the mens rea that's required for the commission of the offense and found that this statute, 273.5, does not require intent to cause injury.
Was that decision under the modified categorical approach?
That was a decision under the categorical approach, and the court found that the crime is not divisible.
Okay, but there isn't any. I don't think that the question of the categorical approach was at issue here with respect to any of these crimes, was it?
No, but the outcome in the case would be different, we believe, today.
Have you sought relief from the BIA on that, or?
We will be filing a motion.
Okay, well, so that's not before us, but you're telling us this, so we're aware of it.
So is your view that we cannot consider it at all?
The 273.5, not that you can't consider it at all, but that it wouldn't form a foundation to remove my client. And without removability, my client maintains his status as a permanent resident.
He committed several offenses, so this was one of them.
Correct. But he was ordered removed on the basis of a finding of two crimes involving moral turpitude. So there would have to be a finding that two of the five offenses, and he has five convictions, two of them would have to be for crimes involving moral turpitude.
And did the BIA and its note, I didn't think this had been briefed at all. You didn't challenge any of his of that basis here, did you?
Not below, Your Honor. So then, because this is an emerging issue of law, we believe that this should be
right. But you had an opportunity. You could have brought this challenge, the one that was decided in Lopez.
Yes, Your Honor. But that was a recent decision.
But what I'm saying is, you could have been the Lopez of this. Latu could have been the Lopez of this court if you
that's,
had brought
that's,
this.
That's fair enough, Your Honor. Fair enough.
Okay. Did you challenge any of the other bases?
I'm sorry. The other crimes?
Yes.
So the agency below found that three of his five crimes were not crimes involving moral turpitude and analyzed those crimes. The agency found two of the crimes were crimes involving moral turpitude, the 273.5 corporal injury and the 1976 attempted rape. So the attempted rape was first charged as an aggravated felony. Later, the immigration judge found that it could not be a basis for removal as an aggravated felony, because it was 1976. It was before 1988, before the Immigration Act was amended to include the aggravated felony definition. And so the only basis that the government had to proceed for removal was the charge of two crimes of moral turpitude. If it was simply one crime of moral turpitude, it wouldn't be a basis to remove my client. So you'd have to have the second crime. So even if we assume that the 1976 attempted rape is a crime of moral turpitude, there has to be a second one. So the court found that the 1991 corporal injury was a crime of moral turpitude. And you are correct. This was, although I should note that in immigration court proceedings, his immigration lawyer at the time did challenge the crime as a crime of moral turpitude, did assert that it's not a crime of moral turpitude and asked for the analysis. And the judge made the analysis and found that it was. We just don't believe that's correct under the current case law.
All right. Well, why don't you, this is informative, but it's not before us. So where do you see the error in what we have before us?
Sure. Well, Your Honor, in this case, the agency agreed, and we believe that the finding was well-founded, that my client had presented unusual and outstanding equities based on his family ties, based on the children that he has supported in the United States, and most specifically the fact that he is the primary caretaker for his youngest child who is severely disabled. And those equities, the agency found, were outstanding. But nonetheless, they denied relief. The immigration judge's decision, the basis for the denial was almost entirely based on a finding that he lacked remorse. That decision, we believe, is logically incoherent because the judge in that same decision found Mr. Latu to be a credible witness and gave his testimony full evidentiary weight.
Is this just an equitable balancing? Because I don't think we have the ability to review that, right?
Well, no, Your Honor. I don't believe that we're asking you to reweigh the equities, but we're looking at the ultimate decision and whether or not the decision is sensible, whether or not it is a capricious decision or a decision that's defensible based on the facts. It's not simply saying that we think that they got it wrong because we think.
But where is the legal error, right? Because I mean, this is one of those cases where there are, you know, features on both sides, right? There's his efforts to care for his family, particularly the disabled child, which is notable. On the other hand, there's, you know, some substantial criminal convictions, including a somewhat recent one for defrauding, you know, people through a contracting business, in addition to the attempted rape and some of the other things that you mentioned. So where's the legal error in what the IJ and BIA did?
Sure. Yes, thank you, Your Honor. And it's true that the most recent offense, 2005, 20 years ago, was for potentially some kind of contract error or overbidding or diversion of funds, and no offense since then, so 20 years without any crime. But the issue here is, what did the court ultimately find to be the basis for an adverse credibility determination?
Well, and there's no adverse credibility. There's nothing.
I'm sorry, I apologize. Adverse discretion.
Yeah, so there's no inconsistency between finding him credible and finding that he's displayed a lack of remorse. Those are not inconsistent.
Well, Your Honor, I beg to differ, just because in his testimony, which again the court gave full weight, he expressed remorse. He expressed.
Well, yeah, but coming to the hearing and saying I'm sorry is not the same as trying to make amends. And one of the things that the judge pointed out was that you had, yes, a 20-year-old diversion of funds conviction, in which he had not made any attempt to provide restitution until the day before the hearing. So 20 years after the crime and the day before the hearing, he decides at that point that he will try to provide some restitution. Now, why is it wrong for an IJ to say this doesn't really demonstrate remorse?
Well, if you balance that against the testimony that he provided, the evidence that he provided, and on all the other evidence in the record, it is a form of cherry picking to find that there was one incident, perhaps because he was indigent or low income and not able to make the restitution that he wanted to make, and to jump from that to the conclusion that he does not deserve this relief after demonstrating outstanding unusual equities. We think there's a gap there. There's something that's missing in the logic to combine that conclusion with the record.
Well, I mean, it wasn't only that, though, right? It was the immigration judge's sense that he was downplaying the severity of the domestic violence, you know, issue.
Well, Your Honor, that's another example of where we believe there was a due process violation, because the only reason that the judge made the conclusion that he was downplaying it is because he disagreed with the contents of a police report that was admitted without ever providing the opportunity to cross-examine the person who made the report or the declarant.
But was that...
Yeah, so,
please go ahead, Judge Gould. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have a question and a comment on the cross-examination issue. My understanding is he never made any request to cross-examine that witness. Who had done the reports to the police.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Judge, I believe that's correct. I don't recall that there was a specific request from the respondent to cross-examine, although the respondent did make a request to cross-examine a police officer for a report related to the 2005 conviction. But even so, the substance of the decision didn't come out until the judge made the decision. So even at that point, the respondent was essentially caught off kilter because he wouldn't have the opportunity to rebut something that he didn't know was going to be an issue in his decision.
Well, I mean, okay. Go ahead, Judge.
Well, here's the point I wanted to make. Mr. Latu has been here in the U.S. for ages, and he's got a big family with U.S. citizen children, and he's got lots of equities on his side. But on the other hand, he has a long history of criminal offenses. I don't know how many exactly there were precisely, but his criminal offenses include an attempted rape and domestic violence. And finally, the more recent diversion of funds. And so I'm just trying for me to see how I can see there's an abuse of discretion of the agency in balancing the equities.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's my opinion, and I believe that both the law and the facts of this case demonstrate that this is the kind of relief that, or this is the type of case that this relief was designed to alleviate. This is a person who committed a crime and who paid the price. He pled guilty. He admits guilt. He accepts the seriousness. He accepts the consequences. For those crimes, we do believe that there has been a significant amount of time to demonstrate rehabilitation. But the statute requires equities. They require demonstration of hardship, and that was demonstrated fully and completely. And it was found by the court and found for good reason based on the significant evidence that there were outstanding and unusual equities. In this case, to nonetheless find as a matter of discretion that this case should be, that this application should be denied, is essentially the court destroying the relief itself.
Okay, we've kept you on the run, so we've let you go over, but we'll put 2 minutes on the clock when you come back.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Welsh. We'll hear from the government.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, this is Greg Kelch representing the respondent, and I begin by thanking the court for allowing me to appear remotely.
Your audio is, I would say, so-so.
Can you hear me now?
That just sounds like you're a little far away from a microphone. Judge Gould, are you able to hear okay?
Could be better, but...
Yeah, that's kind of the same. Just keep your voice up, and hopefully that does the trick.
Yes, does work better for the court? I'm so sorry. We tried it before, and I was told I was coming through loud and clear, but I will keep my voice up. I want to begin by saying I simply am not prepared today to address the issue of his removability. That has not been raised in the opening brief. No supplemental letter brief was filed when the case was reactivated. I don't believe that this argument was exhausted before our agency. And so I'm only here today, I can only here speak today to the issue of 212C relief. The agency found him to be statutorily eligible for this relief. The case came down to whether he merited relief in the exercise of discretion. And the agency's made it very clear that it makes that decision on a case-by-case basis. There are no bright-line rules. And remorse and rehabilitation is part of that conversation. And in this case, I do want to make clear to the court, this is not like a typical immigration case where the immigration judge issues an oral decision at the end of the hearing. The immigration judge issued a written decision 1 year after the hearing. So he thought through the evidence very carefully. And the BIA had a three appellate immigration judge panel. And they all concurred in the decision not to exercise their authority to grant him this waiver. And so as the court has noted, its review is limited here, very limited, just to constitutional claims and questions of law.
Some of the reasons that the IJ became concerned, I think, do stem from the petitioner's testimony as compared to the police reports, the two reports, one of the domestic violence incident, the second involving the diversion of funds from the contracting business. And I guess the question I have for you is, what limits are there on the introduction of those kinds of reports in these proceedings?
Thank you for the question. Our position is that we're talking about two separate reports of two separate incidents at two separate times. And I think we do need to analyze these separately. So, but to start though with the domestic violence report, it is our position that that issue has not been exhausted before the agency. In order to exhaust an issue, he has to put the BIA on notice of his concerns about the domestic violence report. And we say that he did the opposite of that here. He directed the BIA over to the fraud report by Detective Collins and did not ask for any review of the domestic violence report.
Okay, I take your point on this particular issue, but just as a general matter, I mean, you know, a police report can oftentimes take the views of the victim. And, you know, he's then in a position where he is either going to have to agree with those views to show acceptance of responsibility and remorse, or, but at the same time, he's then acknowledging, you know, something that that may be worse than he thinks it was.
So the answer to that is we believe in the court decision in Hernandez v. Gonzalez, where the court held that there is no right of cross-examination for undisputed facts. And when you look at the way that the immigration judge treats that domestic violence report, he recognizes that there's disagreements, but the petitioner testified himself that the victim had bruises and her face was swollen and black and blue. And the immigration judge's concern with this was that during the direct examination, the petitioner described this as just some pushing and shoving. And it wasn't until cross-examination that more of the truth came out. And there is a dispute in the police report about whether the petitioner threw a shoe at her or not, but that's not the evidence that the immigration judge was focusing on. The part that he cites to in the report was the part that the petitioner testified to in his cross-examination. And it was cited for the fact that he didn't take full accounting of his crime during direct examination. So that's the one. But now we have the second one, which is the report, the fraud report. So in Alcaraz Enriquez, the court held that the DHS must make a good faith effort to bring the witness in and make him available for cross-examination. So what is unusual about this case is that Detective Collins did testify. He came in 2012 and he testified and he was available for cross-examination. Due to a technical error, his testimony wasn't recorded. But nonetheless, the petitioner got to hear it and to test it on cross-examination. And when the parties came back—
That was in the course of some much earlier proceeding. Is that what you're referring to?
That is correct. I mean, so the petitioner has been in removal proceedings for 20 years. We had one immigration judge retire. Others had moved off the bench and off the calendar. And finally, we had a final hearing in 2017 with a new immigration judge. And he held that the best way to handle this case would be to have a de novo hearing. We've narrowed the issues. We all agree that he is statutorily eligible for 212C and have one hearing with all the evidence for discretion to determine if he should be granted in the exercise of discretion. Now, at that time, if he wanted Detective Collins to appear, he could have asked for that. The DHS subpoenaed Detective Collins before, so we could have done that again. If the court looks at the police report, Detective Collins writes in his report that he interviewed Mr. Latu, and Mr. Latu said that he used some of this money for his personal expenses. I'm speculating here, but I would imagine that back in 2012, when he was asked about that, how do you know that that happened? What he said was, well, it's in my notes. And I wouldn't have put that down in my notes if it hadn't happened. That's probably all that the cross-examination was. But again, I don't know. I can see that I'm speculating on that point. But in this case, there is no error of law. He had an opportunity to cross-examine the witness. And also just on that point, to the larger point, I think that what the immigration judge was really honed in on with regard to the 2005 fraud conviction was that the petitioner was ordered in 05 to pay restitution. No payment plan had been set up until right before the 2017 hearing, like some dozen years later. So although there is some disagreement about whether Mr. Latu used that money for some of his personal expenses or where he was using it to pay for future construction projects for other clients, I think that the immigration judge's focus was on the not paying the restitution, to not really taking responsibility in the hearing and saying, well, I just made a mistake and I was inexperienced, without really owning up that when he goes into business, he has to keep those money separate from job to job. And for that reason, we contend that there is no error of law. And I also just want to the extent the court might be interested in it, this issue about Ms. Capella being asked about Mr. Latu's conviction for attempted rape. The point I was making in my footnote, I want to make sure it's clear. Suppose hypothetically that the DHS counsel had asked that question. It wouldn't change anything in the case. DHS counsel asking a question of a witness does not demonstrate remorse and rehabilitation on the part of the witness. But moreover, this isn't an error. DHS counsel wanted to ask that question for hardship purposes, to ask, would she still allow Mr. Latu to be alone with Baja if she knew this? And the immigration judge wisely said, we're not going to get into that. She may find out one day, but she doesn't need to find out here in immigration court. Nobody ever said that, the immigration judge did not say that he would not consider that in terms of remorse and rehabilitation. So with only 1 minute left to go, I do want to thank the court for its attention and just express that, you know, this appears to be a closed case. The court's not being asked to reweigh the equities or even to agree or endorse the BIA's decision here, regardless of how you may feel. Simply to recognize that your review is very limited, only for constitutional claims and questions of law. Mr. Latu had full and fair opportunity to present his case, and for that reason, the agency's decision should stand. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Kelch. We'll hear from petitioner.
Thank you, Your Honors. Regarding the question of whether or not the police report should have been admitted or whether or not there was any prejudice caused by the police report. Counsel for DHS made the note that there's no right to cross when undisputed facts are at issue. That's not the question in this case. In fact, the judge was found that there was a lack of remorse because my client's testimony was in dispute of the police report. My client specifically disputed certain portions of the report and contended that they were not accurate. The judge in his decision simply decided not to believe my client after having found him to be credible and giving his testimony full evidentiary weight. We believe that that contradiction and the fact that he was ultimately found to be lacking remorse on the basis of a report that is hearsay and was not provided the opportunity to cross-examine.
How about just like the bruises, for example? Like initially it seemed that he testified on direct that there was more pushing and shoving. Then he did acknowledge on cross that there was sort of a black and blue bruising. So was that impermissible for the IJ to take into account that issue?
No. And certainly the judge did summarize that as well. But nonetheless, the finding of trivialization wasn't simply based on the testimony that he was providing on cross-examination. It was because he was not admitting to facts that were in the police report, which he shouldn't be compelled to do. And the fact that the judge was essentially compelling him to admit something that he shouldn't have to admit in order for him to get relief is a bit of a legal conundrum.
Well, I mean, the IJ says, you know, the respondent didn't accept responsibility. This is talking now about the diversion of funds. He didn't accept responsibility for his actions. He blamed his lack of experience to excuse his diverting of funds. I mean, is there anything about that that's inconsistent with the police report? That seems like just an observation from his testimony.
No, may be well observed. But nonetheless, if the judge is finding him to be credible, why is he disbelieving his assertion that he lacked the knowledge? If my client credibly testified that he was inexperienced and that he had made a mistake and he took responsibility for that mistake, why is the judge then concluding that that statement is not true? Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Thank both counsel for the briefing and argument. And this case is submitted.